Imagine buying a guaranteed financial asset. Like, you hold it for 30 years, you receive every single penny you were promised by the issuer, you do everything perfectly right.
Right.
And then on the day it matures, you realize you've lost massive amounts of your purchasing power.
Oh, yeah, it happens all the time.
Today, we are cracking open the absolute bedrock of the financial markets, which is bond yields and pricing. But before we jump into today's deep dive, a quick shout out to CertFuel.
Yeah.
This deep dive is brought to you by them. So if you are prepping for your Series 7, they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and, you know, unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge.
It's totally huge. You can check it out at certfuel.com. All right. So let's unpack this. We have a massive mission today. Yield is the absolute language of the bond market.
Oh, 100%.
And if you don't speak it, the Series 7 is just going to eat you alive.
It really is the foundation.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just memorize flashcards here and hope to scrape by.
Right.
You have to understand the actual physical mechanics underneath all the math. So today we're going to tear apart how bond pricing actually works, the hierarchy of yields, the frankly bizarre rules of accrued interest.
So bizarre.
Yeah, the reality of credit ratings, and finally, how the IRS inevitably gets its hands on your returns.
Because they always do.
Always. But it all connects. And once you see the logic, you really won't have to memorize a single thing.
And because reading financial mechanics off a dry syllabus is like a guaranteed way to lose focus, we're bringing in a recurring cast of characters to live out these scenarios for us.
I love this.
Yeah. So first we have cautious Kathy. Now, Kathy loves safety. She hates surprises. She never checks her portfolio on a red day. And she holds zero coupon bonds in her IRA just so she can sleep like a baby.
We all know a cautious Kathy.
We do. Next, we have desperate Dave.
Oh, boy.
Dave is chaos. He constantly chases high yields without reading the fine print. He has horrific market timing, and he is famous for buying premium bonds right before interest rates do something crazy.
Classic Dave.
Classic Dave. And finally, on the other side of the table, we have corporate Carl. Carl is the guy actually issuing the debt. He is ruthless, he's pragmatic, and he literally only cares about minimizing his company's borrowing costs.
Makes sense. He's running a business.
Exactly. So keeping these three in mind, let's start with the absolute fundamental rule of fixed income.
Yeah, the bedrock of everything in the bond market is the inverse relationship between price and yield.
Right.
Simply put, when market interest rates go up, the prices of existing bonds go down. And when market rates fall, existing bond prices rise.
They act like a seesaw.
Exactly like a seesaw. If one side goes up, the physical laws of the market dictate the other side must come down.
Okay, I hear that all the time. But let's actually explain why. Like, the old textbook analogy is a teeter-totter, which is fine for, you know, a kindergartner.
Right, right.
But let's put this into a real-world scenario. Imagine corporate Carl doesn't sell bonds. Imagine he sells commercial real estate.
Okay, I'm with you.
So you buy a small office building from Carl, and it comes with a rock-solid, unbreakable 10-year lease where the tenant is legally forced to pay you $10,000 a month.
That's a great asset. You've basically locked in your yield.
Right. But a year later, the commercial real estate market crashes. Nobody is renting.
Ouch.
Yeah. If someone were to buy a new building today, the best lease they could get is only $5,000 a month. So suddenly, my building with its locked in, unbreakable $10,000 lease is like the most attractive thing in town.
Oh, absolutely.
If Desperate Dave wants to buy my building, I'm not going to sell it to him for what I paid for it.
No way.
I'm going to charge him a massive premium because my lease pays out double what the current market offers.
And that is exactly what happens with a bond. I mean, the interest rate on a bond, the coupon, is locked in stone the day corporate Carl issues it.
It never changes.
Right. It is fixed. But the broader economy is constantly shifting. The Federal Reserve is changing rates. Inflation is moving. So because the coupon cannot physically change, the bond's price is the only available shock absorber.
Okay, shock absorber. I like that.
Yeah, the price has to fluctuate to keep the bond's overall return competitive with whatever new bonds are doing today.
So let's reverse the real estate scenario. Let's say I own that building paying $10,000 a month, but the market booms.
Okay.
Now, brand new buildings are renting for $20,000 a month. If I try to sell my old building to Dave, he's going to laugh at me.
Right, because why would he buy yours?
Exactly. He'd say, why would I pay full price for your $10,000 asset when I can go to Carl and get a new $20,000 asset?
He wouldn't.
Right. The only mathematical way I can convince Dave to buy my building is if I drastically slash the asking price. I have to discount it until the math balances out for him.
Which perfectly illustrates the three states of a bond. You've got discount, premium, and par.
Let's break those down.
Sure. So this entire classification is based entirely on how your bond's fixed coupon compares to the prevailing winds of the market.
Right.
If your bond is trading below its standard $1,000 par value, it is at a discount. That happens because your coupon rate is weaker than the current market rate.
It's inferior.
Exactly.
Right.
The market demands a better return, so your bond's price has to drop to compensate the new buyer.
Okay, pattern interrupt right here. Pause. Listen to my voice.
Listen up.
If interest rates in the market just fell off a cliff, what just happened to the price of Cautious Cathy's existing bonds?
Think about it. Boom.
Boom. Prices go up.
Yep, the seesaw effect.
And what's wild to me about buying a bond at a discount is that the discount itself actually becomes part of the buyer's return.
Oh, precisely. That's a huge point. If Dave buys your bond at a discount for, say, $900, he is still going to receive the full $1,000 par value from Corporate Carl when the bond matures.
He gets the full thousand.
The full thousand. That extra $100 isn't a mistake. It's a built-in capital gain that makes up for the crappy coupon rate he had to endure along the way.
Wow. Okay, so let's look at the flip side. A premium bond. This is trading above $1,000. Why? Because the coupon rate is juicier than the current market.
Right.
So Cautious Cathy owns a bond paying 8%, and the new bonds Carl is issuing only pay 4%. Everyone in the market wants Cathy's 8% bond, so they bid the price up to, let's say, $1,100.
But here's the critical catch, and it's the exact trap Desperate Dave always falls into.
He always does.
He does. That premium represents a guaranteed capital loss.
Wait, really? A guaranteed loss?
Yes. If Dave buys Cathy's bond for $1,100 today just to chase that high 8% yield, he has to accept a harsh reality. When the bond matures in 10 years, Corporate Carl does not care what Dave paid for it in the secondary market.
Carl's only legally obligated to hand Dave $1,000.
Exactly. Dave takes a $100 loss on the principal.
Man, so he pays a markup for the privilege of the high cash flow, knowing he'll get dinged at the end.
Yep. And then, of course, there's par.
Right.
The bond trades exactly at $1,000. This only happens when the bond's coupon perfectly matches whatever the current market is demanding. No premium, no discount.
Just flat.
Yeah.
Okay, so understanding that prices are constantly swinging to absorb market changes, we run into a major problem for investors. How do you actually measure and compare your return when the price is a moving target?
And that brings us to the hierarchy of yields, the alphabet soup of fixed income.
The alphabet soup. Let's start with the simplest one, the anchor, nominal yield.
Yeah, nominal yield is just the annual interest rate printed in ink right on the face of the bond.
It's printed right there.
Exactly. It is the annual coupon payment divided by the par value. So if Corporate Carl issues a bond paying $60 a year on a $1,000 par value, the nominal yield is 6%.
Okay, so let me ask you this. If inflation goes absolutely ballistic tomorrow and the Federal Reserve hikes interest rates to 15%, what happens to the nominal yield on that bond?
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
Absolutely nothing. Nominal yield is a fixed contract. It does not care about inflation. It doesn't care about the Fed. It doesn't care if the price of the bond crashes to $200. It is permanently 6% of par.
And this is where the exam tries to get you. They will write a three-paragraph story about a chaotic economic collapse and ask how the nominal yield changed. The answer is always that it stays exactly the same.
Every time.
But because it doesn't change, it's pretty useless for someone buying a bond today, right? I mean, if I'm buying a bond at a massive discount, nominal yield doesn't tell me what I'm actually earning on my money.
Right, which is why we move one step down the hierarchy to current yield. The formula for current yield is the annual coupon payment divided by the current market price of the bond.
Okay, so current yield is basically asking a very specific short-sighted question. It's asking, if I drop a bag of cash to buy this bond today, what percentage of my purchase price comes back to me as cash this year?
Exactly. It's a snapshot.
Right.
So if Desperate Dave buys a premium bond for $1,100 and it pays a $60 coupon, his current yield is 60 divided by 1100, which is about 5.4%. But notice what's missing there.
It totally ignores the future. Like, it completely ignores the fact that Dave is guaranteed to lose $100 when the bond matures and Carl only gives him $1,000 back.
It's a massive blind spot. Current yield only cares about income relative to your entry price. It is completely blind to capital gains or capital losses at maturity.
Which brings us to the heavyweight champion of bond math, yield to maturity, or YTM. In the industry, if a trader asks for a bond's basis, this is what they mean.
Yep, the basis. YTM is the total annualized return you will experience if you buy the bond today and hold it until the exact day it matures.
It accounts for everything.
It really does. It takes the annual coupon payments,
yeah.
It factors in the time value of money, and crucially, it bakes in any capital gain if you bought at a discount, or any capital loss if you bought at a premium.
Okay, but hold on. I want to push back on YTM because there is a massive, almost absurd assumption hiding inside this math.
The reinvestment assumption.
Yes, the reinvestment assumption. Explain this to me because it sounds like a complete fantasy.
Well, it is a mathematical fantasy, but it's one the entire global bond market agrees to play along with.
Okay, how does it work?
The math behind yield to maturity assumes that every single time Corporate Carl sends you a semi-annual interest check, you take that cash and instantly reinvest it into a new investment that pays the exact same YTM rate.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, if I have a bond with an 8% YTM and 3 years later interest rates across the world have plummeted to 2%, I cannot magically reinvest my new coupon payments at 8%.
You can't. The market won't let you. So you're right. In a falling rate environment, your actual realized return will be lower than the stated YTM because you are reinvesting those coupons at weaker rates. This is literally called reinvestment risk.
Reinvestment risk, okay.
But the industry uses the YTM formula because it's really the only way to create a standardized apples-to-apples comparison between two bonds with completely different coupons, prices, and maturities.
It's a flawed metric, but it's the best tape measure we have.
Right.
Okay, so YTM assumes we hold it to the bitter end. But what if Corporate Carl doesn't let us? What if Carl decides to pull the plug early?
Enter the call feature. And this brings us to yield to call, or YTC. Let's look at Carl's motivation here.
Let's do it.
Carl issued a bond 5 years ago, paying an 8% coupon. But today, the market has cooled off, and Carl realizes he could issue brand new corporate debt at 4%. Why would he keep paying 8% when he could borrow at 4%?
He wouldn't. He's a pragmatist. He's looking at his balance sheet going, I need to get rid of this expensive debt.
Right. So if the bond have a call feature, Carl will absolutely exercise it. He forces the bondholders to hand the bonds back. He pays them the par value, often with a little small call premium attached as an apology, and he refinances his debt at the new 4% rate.
Makes total business sense.
It does. And yield to call calculates the investor's return, assuming this exact scenario happens at the earliest possible call date.
Now, here is where the exam sets a brutal trap. You have to understand when a bond is quoted on yield to call versus yield to maturity.
Oh, this is heavily tested.
Yeah. If I'm looking at a premium bond, one that's trading at $1,100, it is always quoted based on yield to call. But a discount bond is always quoted on yield to maturity. Why is that?
Well, put yourself in Carl's shoes. A premium bond exists because its coupon is much higher than the current market rates. So Carl is bleeding money paying an above market interest rate.
Right. He hates that.
He hates it. He is absolutely highly motivated to call that bond to save his company cash. But a discount bond exists because its coupon is lower than the current market.
So Carl is paying 3% while everyone else is paying 6%.
Exactly. He's getting a steal. He would never, ever call that bond. He's going to let that cheap 3% debt ride until the absolute final day.
He has zero financial incentive to call it.
Right. And this logic dictates the SEC requirement of quoting yield to worst.
Yield to worst.
A broker dealer must always quote a client the lowest possible yield they might receive, assuming the issuer doesn't default. You have to show them the worst case scenario.
Protect the investor.
Exactly. So for a premium bond, the worst case scenario is that it gets called away early, which stops the gravy train of high coupon payments and accelerates that capital loss we talked about.
Mm.
So for premium bonds, the yield to worst is always the yield to call.
Okay, let's visualize this. This is the yield hierarchy. If you are a visual learner, draw a straight horizontal line on a page, like right in the middle.
Yep, right in the middle.
That line is par. That line is the nominal yield.
Ah.
Now, let's say Desperate Joseph buys a bond at a massive premium. The price is way above the line. How do the yields stack up?
Okay, so for a premium bond, nominal yield is the highest number. Let's say it's 8%. Current yield will be lower, maybe 7.5% because you paid a high price for it.
Okay.
Yield to maturity will be even lower, say 7%, because it factors in the capital loss you'll take at maturity. And yield to call is the absolute lowest. maybe 6%. Because if Carl calls it early, you take that capital loss over a much shorter time period, which just crushes your annualized return.
Now flip it. Cautious Kathy buys a bond at a deep discount. It's way below the line.
The hierarchy perfectly reverses. Nominal yield is now the lowest number. Let's say it's 3%. Current yield is higher, maybe 3.5% because she bought it on sale.
She got a deal.
Right. Yield to maturity is even higher, say 4%, because it adds in the guaranteed capital gain she gets when the bond matures at par.
And yield to call.
Yield to call is the absolute highest, maybe 5%, because if Carl is crazy enough to call a discount bond, Kathy gets that massive capital gain immediately, turbocharging her annualized return.
Okay, direct question. Test time. Pause and think about this before I answer.
Give him a second.
Desperate Dave buys a premium bond. He K'd way above par. Which number is going to be higher on his statement? His current yield or his yield to maturity?
Think about the mechanics of the premium.
It's his current yield. Current yield is a dumb metric. It just looks at the coupon divided by his high purchase price and completely ignores the future. But yield to maturity is smart. It factors in the harsh reality that Dave is going to lose money on the principal when Carl only hands him $1,000 at the end. That guaranteed loss drags his YTM down below his current yield.
Beautifully explained. But before we move off yields entirely, we really need to flag one oddball, which is the discount yield.
Oh, the oddball.
Yeah, it's used for money market instruments like U.S. Treasury bills.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't play by the standard rules.
It's completely different math.
It is. First, it assumes a 360-day year. But more importantly, the formula divides the discount by the face value of the bond, not the purchase price.
Wait, the face value?
Yes. And because the face value, $1,000, is always a larger number than whatever discounted price you paid, putting it in the denominator means the discount yield always mathematically understates the investor's true actual return.
Understates it. Wow. All right, so we've mapped out how to measure the return, but we know prices swing like a pendulum based on rates. The question is, how violently do they swing?
Right.
Like, what makes one bond stable and another bond completely unhinged?
This is the concept of price sensitivity or duration. For the exam, you really need to understand two primary levers that dictate how volatile a bond's price will be. And those are maturity and the coupon rate.
Okay, let's pull the first lever, maturity.
The longer the time until a bond matures, the more wildly sensitive its price is to interest rate changes. A 30-year bond is exponentially more volatile than a 2-year bond.
Why is that?
Because a change in interest rates today affects 30 years worth of future cash flows. There is vastly more time for the market to move against you or to move for you.
Let's go back to the seesaw analogy. If you are sitting 2 feet from the center pivot, someone can push the seesaw and you barely move. That's a 2-year bond.
Barely feel it.
Right. But if you are sitting 30 feet out on the absolute end of the plank, a tiny push in the middle launches you into the stratosphere.
That is a perfect visual for duration.
So what about the second lever?
The second lever is the coupon rate. The lower the coupon, the more volatile the bond.
Wait, the lower the coupon?
Yes. This is because a high coupon bond pays you a lot of heavy cash flow early in the bond's life. That cash flow cushions the blow if rates change. But a low coupon bond pays you very little along the way. Almost all of your return is locked up in that final principal payment decades from now, which makes it highly sensitive to rate shifts today.
So if we combine those two rules, the most volatile, hypersensitive roller coaster bond in the entire financial system would be what?
A long-term zero coupon bond.
Like a 30-year zero.
It's exactly. Usually a 30-year zero. It has the maximum possible time to maturity and the absolute minimum possible coupon. It is maximally sensitive. If the Fed chairman even sneezes, the price of a 30-year zero coupon bond swings violently.
Which means cautious Kathy, who hates surprises, should be terrified of a 30-year zero if she thinks rates are going to move.
She would be.
But despite all this volatility in the middle of a bond's life, there is an inescapable gravitational pull at the end.
Yes, we call it pull to par.
Pull to par.
Right. No matter how wildly a bond trades, whether it's at a steep discount of $700 or a massive premium of $1,300, as the days tick closer to maturity, the market price mathematically converges toward $1,000.
It just has to.
It has to. Because everyone knows that on the final day, corporate Carl is only writing a check for exactly $1,000.
Time heals all premiums and discounts. Now, let's talk about the actual mechanics of buying these things. When I look at my brokerage screen, how are these bonds quoted? Because it honestly feels like they all speak different languages.
They do. It's a mess. First, let's define the measurement unit, which is a basis point.
A bip.
A bip, yeah. A basis point is 0.01%, so 0.01%. If a bond yield moves from 5.00% to 5.10%, it moved up by 10 basis points.
Mm.
It's how professionals discuss really microscopic changes.
Okay, now for the quoting conventions. If Corporate Carl issues a corporate bond, it is quoted as a percentage of par in dollar terms using decimals or fractions. So a quote of 98.50 means 98.5% of $1,000, which is $985. Pretty straightforward.
It is. But municipal bonds get a little trickier. They're often quoted on a yield basis.
What does that mean?
Well, you won't see a dollar price on the screen. You'll just see a yield, like 4.25. You have to use a financial calculator to back into the actual dollar price based on that yield.
Okay. But the absolute deadliest trap on the exam is how U.S. government bonds, treasuries, are quoted.
Oh, this is brutal.
The exam writers will try to murder you on this.
They will. Government bonds are quoted as a percentage of par, but they use 30 seconds instead of decimals.
30 seconds?
Yes, 30 seconds. And they denote it with a dash or a period.
This is exactly where they set the trap. Listen carefully to this part. If a test question says a U.S. Treasury bond is quoted at 99-16, what is the dollar price? Give yourself a beat.
Think about the 30 seconds.
If you say $99.16, you fail the question.
The dash is the dead giveaway. It means 99 and 16/30 seconds. 16 out of 32 is exactly one half. So it's 99.5% of par, which means the bond costs $995.
You have to translate the fraction before you do the math.
Oh.
Okay, so we've got the price. Let's talk about actually settling the trade. Let's say cautious Kathy decides she wants to sell her corporate bond to desperate Dave.
Okay.
The bond pays interest every 6 months, but Kathy gets bored and sells it to Dave exactly 4 months into the 6-month cycle. Kathy held the bond for 4 months. She deserves 4 months of interest.
Fair enough.
But Corporate Carl is a pragmatist. He only writes one check every 6 months, and he's going to send it to whoever owns the bond on payment day, which will be Dave.
And this is why the system invented accrued interest. It is the mechanism that splits the pie perfectly fairly.
How does it work?
When Dave buys the bond from Kathy on the settlement date, he has to pay her the agreed-upon market price of the bond. Plus, he has to reach into his own pocket and pay her for exactly 4 months of accrued interest.
Wait, Dave has to front her the money. Why would he ever agree to that?
Because Dave knows he's going to be made whole. 2 months later, Corporate Carl is going to send Dave a check for a full 6 months of interest. Dave only owned the bond for 2 months, but he gets the 6-month check.
Mm-hmm.
That check reimburses Dave for the 4 months he fronted to Kathy and leaves him with 2 months of interest he actually earned.
Wow, so the math is perfectly balanced.
It is.
But to calculate exactly how many days of interest Dave owes Kathy, we need to know what kind of calendar we're using. And in finance, they don't all use the same calendar.
They definitely don't. For corporate bonds and municipal bonds, the industry decided that real calendars were just too messy. So they invented a standardized fictional calendar called the 33-60-day count convention.
33-60?
Yeah. They pretend that every single month of the year has exactly 30 days, including February, and that the year has exactly 360 days. It makes the accounting math beautifully simple.
But the U.S. government does not play make-believe.
No, they do not.
For treasury bonds, they use actual. You have to look at a physical calendar and count the literal days. If it's a leap year and February has 29 days, you count 29 days.
Exactly.
Okay, pattern interrupt right here. Mnemonic device time, because you will get tested on this. Remember the letters. Corporate and municipal use 3360, C and M. Government uses actual, G and A. If a question asks you to calculate accrued interest on a corporate bond and you use 31 days for August, they will absolutely have a trap answer waiting for you based on that mistake. C&M is 30.
Now, there are scenarios where Dave wouldn't owe Kathy a dime of accrued interest. This is called trading flat.
When does a bond trade flat?
Mostly when the interest payment is in doubt or non-existent. First, bonds in default. If Corporate Carl's company is bankrupt and he hasn't paid interest in a year, Dave isn't going to front Kathy any accrued interest because Dave knows he's never getting a check from Carl to reimburse him.
That makes total sense.
Second, income bonds, also called adjustment bonds. These only pay interest if the company hits specific revenue targets. Since the payment isn't legally guaranteed, it doesn't accrue.
Okay.
And finally, zero coupon bonds. There is no periodic cash flow to accrue in the first place, so they always trade flat.
Okay, so Kathy and Dave have the price, they've settled the accrued interest. But there is a massive elephant in the room. They are lending money to corporate Carl. How do they actually know if Carl is good for it? Like, how do they know he won't default?
That is the ultimate risk in fixed income, and it's why the bond rating agencies exist.
The big three.
Right. The big three are Standard & Poor's,
right.
Fitch, and Moody's. Their entire business model is to analyze an issuer like corporate Carl,
right.
And assign a grade to his likelihood of defaulting.
But let me be very clear about what these ratings actually are, because the exam will try to twist your understanding of them. A AAA rating from S&P is not a legal guarantee.
Not at all.
It is not an insurance policy. It is merely a highly educated, deeply researched opinion. A AAA-rated corporation can still go bankrupt and default on its debt. If a test question implies a rating eliminates default risk, it is straight up lying to you.
Absolutely. It's an assessment of probability, not certainty.
Right.
The agencies use letter grades. S&P and Fitch use all capital letters, starting at AAA and walking down to D for default. Moody's uses a mix of upper and lowercase, like capital A, lowercase a.
But the only thing you truly need to memorize for the exam is the cliff edge, the dividing line between safety and chaos.
The investment grade cutoff.
Yes.
Right. So a bond is considered investment grade if it is rated BBB- by S&P and Fitch, or Ba3 by Moody's, or anything higher.
Okay.
The absolute second a bond gets downgraded one tiny notch below that line to BB+ or Ba1, it loses its investment grade status. It officially becomes a high yield or junk bond.
Let's talk about the absolute carnage that causes in the real world. Let's say corporate Carl has a bad earnings call and S&P downgrades his debt from BBB- to BB+. It's just one notch down on a spreadsheet.
Just one tiny notch.
But in the market, the price of Carl's bonds doesn't just dip, it completely craters overnight. Why is that one specific line so destructive?
It comes down to forced institutional selling.
Forced selling.
Yes. It's a structural market dump. Massive players in the market, like state pension funds, life insurance companies, conservative mutual funds, they all have strict legal charters governing what they can own. Their bylaws state they are legally prohibited from holding non-investment grade debt, period.
Wow.
So the morning Carl's bond drops to BB+, all of those institutions are legally forced to liquidate their positions simultaneously.
They all hit the sell button at the exact same time.
Exactly. A tidal wave of supply floods the market. But because it's now officially junk, conservative buyers won't touch it. Massive supply, zero demand, the price just plummets.
And as we know from the seesaw, when the price plummets, the yield skyrockets. Carl's cost of borrowing just went to the moon. He's in real trouble now.
Which is a perfect segue into credit spreads.
Yeah.
A credit spread is the difference in yield between a risk-free bond, like a U.S. Treasury, and a risky bond, like Carl's corporate debt.
So it's a gap.
Right. That spread, that gap in percentage points, is the exact premium investors demand to take on the risk that Carl might default.
And those spreads aren't static. They breathe in and out with the economy.
They do. In a booming economy, investors are greedy and confident. They don't mind taking risks.
Right.
So the yield gap between safe treasuries and risky corporates shrinks. We say credit spreads narrow.
Okay.
But when a recession hits and panic sets in, we see a flight to quality. Investors dump their risky corporate bonds and flood their cash into safe U.S. treasuries.
So corporate bond prices crash, meaning their yields go up, and treasury prices surge, meaning their yields go down. The two yields violently pull apart from each other.
Exactly. The spread widens. A widening credit spread is a massive red flag that the market is terrified of an upcoming recession.
So if prices are swinging based on rates and spreads are widening based on panic, how does a portfolio manager actually survive this? Let's say Desperate Dave is reading the Wall Street Journal, and he is absolutely convinced that the Fed is going to hike interest rates to the moon next week.
Dave's always convinced of something.
He is. What should he do to his bond portfolio right now?
If he is crumbing, certain rates are rising, he needs to protect his capital. Rising rates mean falling bond prices. And as we discussed earlier, the bonds that fall the hardest are the long-term ones.
The 30-year zeros.
Right. So Dave needs to shorten his maturities. He should sell his 30-year bonds and hide his money in short-term instruments, like one-year treasury bills. They have very little price sensitivity, so they will survive the rate hike mostly intact.
And conversely, if he thinks rates are about to plummet, he should extend maturities. buy 30-year bonds, because when rates drop, those long-term bond prices will launch into orbit and he'll make a fortune in capital gains.
Exactly.
But here's the reality. Dave is not a psychic. Nobody is. So how do you manage a portfolio when you admit you have no idea what rates will do?
You build a bond ladder.
A ladder.
A laddered portfolio intentionally spreads your purchases out across multiple different maturities. You buy some one-year bonds, some three-year, some five-year, and some 10-year bonds.
And then what?
Well, as the one-year bonds mature and hand you back your cash, you take that money and buy new 10-year bonds to put at the back of the ladder.
It's a self-sustaining machine.
Yes.
And it takes the guesswork out. Like, if interest rates go up, you aren't sad because you constantly have bonds maturing, giving you fresh cash to reinvest at the new higher rates.
Exactly.
And if rates go down, you aren't sad because you still have those 5- and 10-year bonds locked in at the old higher rates. It perfectly diversifies your interest rate risk.
It really does. Now, the absolute opposite of a ladder is a bullet strategy. This is where you construct a portfolio so that every single bond you own matures in the exact same year.
Which sounds incredibly risky. Why would you put all your eggs in one chronological basket?
You do it when you have a massive, non-negotiable cash liability on a specific future date.
Give me an example.
The classic example is a college tuition bill. Let's say your kid starts college in exactly 8 years, and you know you'll need $200,000. You don't want a ladder. A ladder means some of your money is tied up for 10 years.
Right, you need the cash now.
Exactly. You want to buy a mix of bonds that all mature in exactly 8 years. That way, thanks to the pull to par, on the day tuition is due, every single bond hands you back its principal. You write the check to the university, and you are completely insulated from whatever interest rates did in the interim.
Okay, we've priced the bond, we've settled the trade, we survived the credit downgrade, and we built the ladder. We've made our profit.
Okay, we survived.
We did. But now, we have to face the final boss. The IRS. Let's talk about the tax man.
The rules for taxing fixed income are incredibly specific, and they depend entirely on who issued the bond and how you acquired it.
Right.
Let's start with basic coupon interest.
Okay, I'll rapid fire this. Corporate bonds, like corporate Carl's, they're fully taxable at every level, federal, state, and local. The government takes a bite out of every check.
Every single one.
U.S. Treasury bonds. Uncle Sam taxes them at the federal level, but as a perk, they're completely exempt from state and local taxes.
But then we get to agency debt. Securities issued by government-sponsored entities like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae.
And this is a massive exam trap. The test will try to lure you into assuming that because they are government agencies, they get the same state tax exemption as treasuries. They do not.
They absolutely do not.
Most agency securities, including the massive mortgage-backed securities from Ginnie Mae, are fully taxable at all levels, federal, state, and local.
Only a very specific few, like Farm Credit System bonds or Federal Home Loan Bank bonds, get the state tax exemption. Do not let them trick you into assuming government means tax-free at the state level.
Great point. Now, we need to wade into the deepest waters of bond taxation. The exam heavily tests the difference between original issue discount, or OID,
okay,
and market discount.
They sound like the same thing, but the IRS treats them with completely different logic.
Let's start with OID, original issue discount. This happens at the very birth of the bond. Corporate Carl decides to issue a brand new zero coupon bond. The par value is $1,000.
Right.
But because it pays zero interest along the way, no one will pay full price for it. So Carl sells it to cautious Kathy on day one for $600. The $400 difference between what she paid and the par value she'll get in 10 years is the original issue discount.
Now here is where the IRS gets incredibly aggressive.
Like they usually do.
Over the next 10 years, Kathy is not receiving a single dime in cash from Carl. But the IRS looks at that $400 discount and says, Kathy, we know you are mathematically earning a portion of that discount every single year as the bond pulls to par.
Wait, hold up. Are you telling me the IRS expects Kathy to pay real cash taxes on money she hasn't even received yet? How is that even legal?
Oh, it's legal. It's called phantom income.
Phantom income?
Yes. The IRS legally requires Kathy to accrete, which means to add a mathematically calculated portion of that discount to her taxable income every single year. She's paying taxes out of her own pocket on interest that exists only on a spreadsheet.
That is brutal. If Kathy holds that in a regular taxable brokerage account, it's going to destroy her cash flow.
Exactly, which is the golden rule of OID zero coupon bonds. They should almost always be placed in a tax-deferred account, like a traditional IRA. Inside the IRA, the phantom income is shielded from the IRS year after year.
Okay, but let's look at the mechanics if she does hold it in a taxable account, because the exam tests this. As Kathy pays taxes on this phantom income every year, the IRS doesn't want to tax her twice.
Right.
So they allow her to adjust her cost basis upward. Her basis steps up from 600, 640 to 685, just constantly rising each year.
And this is the punchline. By the time the bond finally matures in 10 years, Kathy's adjusted cost basis has stepped up to exactly $1,000.
Wow.
So when Corporate Carl hands her the $1,000 check, her basis is $1,000, her proceeds are $1,000, and she realizes zero capital gains. The IRS already extracted their pound of flesh by taxing the discount as ordinary income along the way.
That is wild. Okay, now let's compare that to market discount. This happens in the secondary market.
Right.
Let's say Corporate Carl issues a totally normal, boring 5% bond at $1,000. But 2 years later, interest rates skyrocket. The bond's price crashes in the secondary market.
Standard seesaw.
Right. Desperate Dave logs into his brokerage and buys that bond from some other investor for $900. That $100 difference is market discount.
Right. And Dave holds it to maturity. And Carl gives him $1,000. Dave made $100 on the price.
So Dave buys an asset for $900, sells it for $1,000. That's a textbook capital gain, right? He gets the, like, lower capital gains tax rate?
No.
No.
No, and this is exactly why the exam loves this concept. The IRS says, Dave, you didn't buy a stock that went up in value. You bought a debt instrument below par.
Oh.
The IRS views that $100 market discount as deferred interest income that Dave essentially bought on sale. Therefore, when Dave gets his $1,000 at maturity, that entire $100 profit is taxed as ordinary income at his highest tax bracket.
The IRS always wins. But what's the difference between this and ORID? Does Dave have to deal with phantom income while he holds it?
No, and that's the key distinction. With market discount, annual recognition of that income is elective.
Oh, elective.
Yeah, Dave can choose to claim it every year, but most people don't. He can simply wait until the bond matures, take his $100, and pay the ordinary income tax all at once at the end.
Okay, so if buying at a discount is ordinary income, what happens if Dave buys a bond at a premium? Like, Dave pays $1,100 for a bond that will only return $1,000 at maturity. He's mathematically guaranteed to lose $100. Will the IRS let him write off that loss?
Yes, through a process called premium amortization.
Amortization, okay.
You are slowly writing off that $100 loss over the remaining years of the bond's life. But the rules differ wildly depending on whether it's a taxable corporate bond or a tax-exempt municipal bond.
Okay, let's start with a taxable corporate bond. For this, amortization is elective. Dave can choose to do it.
And he usually will. If he elects to amortize, he gets to reduce the amount of interest income he reports to the IRS each year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. If the bond pays $100 in interest, but he amortizes $10 of his premium loss, he only pays taxes on $90 of income. It lowers his current tax bill.
But there's a catch, right?
Of course. In exchange, he must reduce his cost basis by $10 every year.
So by the time maturity hits, his basis has been amortized down from $1,100 to exactly $1,000. When Carl hands him $1,000, he has no capital loss to claim. He took the benefit along the way.
Exactly. But now let's look at tax-exempt municipal bonds. For munis, premium amortization is absolutely mandatory. You are legally required to do it.
Wait, why would the IRS force you to do it?
Because the IRS hates double dipping. Think about it. Municipal bond interest is already tax-free.
Right.
If Dave didn't have to amortize, he could collect tax-free interest for 10 years. And then at maturity, he'd have a cost basis of $1,100, receive $1,000, and claim a $100 capital loss to offset his other taxes.
Oh, I see. The IRS won't allow that.
Not a chance. So they force him to amortize his basis down by $10 a year. But because the interest is tax-free, that amortization doesn't give him any tax deduction along the way.
It's just phantom amortization.
Essentially, yes. It just steadily erodes his cost basis until it hits exactly $1,000 at maturity, legally preventing him from ever claiming a capital loss on a tax-free bond.
The IRS thought of literally everything.
They really did. And that leads to the final tax rule. If Dave gets impatient and sells his bond in the secondary market before it matures, we have to calculate capital gains. The rule you must remember for the exam is that you always calculate your capital gain or loss against your adjusted cost basis, not your original purchase price.
This is crucial for OID bonds. If Kathy bought that zero coupon bond for $600, held it for 5 years, stepped her basis up to $800, and then sold it for $850, her capital gain is $50.
Right.
It is not $250. If you use the original $600 purchase price on the exam, you will get the wrong answer, and I guarantee you it will be choice A or B on the screen. Always use the adjusted basis.
All of these tax mechanics prove that looking at yield in a vacuum is just dangerous. A high-yield corporate bond might look incredible on paper, but once the federal, state, and local governments take their cut and you factor in amortization, a boring, lower-yielding, tax-free municipal bond might actually put significantly more physical cash in your bank account.
Wow. All right. We have covered an immense amount of ground, from commercial real estate seesaws to the IRS double-dipping rules. Let's lock this in. We are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most testable concepts from this unit. I'll fire off the setup. You finish the sentence. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
The fundamental teeter-totter. Interest rates go up, existing bond prices
go down, they move inversely.
The single most wildly volatile, hypersensitive bond you can possibly buy.
A long-term zero coupon bond.
For a discount bond, what is the yield hierarchy from highest to lowest?
Yield to call is the highest, then yield to maturity, then current yield, and nominal is at the bottom.
The critical cliff edge line for investment grade credit ratings.
Triple B minus for S&P, or B at a 3 for Moody's. Anything below that triggers the institutional dump into junk territory.
Accrued interest day count convention for corporate and municipal bonds.
C&M use 3360.
And for U.S. Treasuries,
governments use actual.
Finally, taxation on an original issue discount zero coupon bond.
You suffer annual phantom income, tax at ordinary rates,
yeah.
So shield it in an IRA.
Boom. That is the core machinery of debt yields and pricing. But before we sign off, leave us with one final provocative thought. Something that takes all this pristine textbook math and just smashes it into the real world.
All right. Well, we spent a lot of time today talking about yield to maturity.
Right.
It is the gold standard metric of the industry. But remember the dark secret of YTM. It relies entirely on the reinvestment assumption. It assumes you can perfectly reinvest every single coupon payment you receive at that exact same rate, year after year, decade after decade.
Which is crazy.
It is. Now think about the real world. Think about the economic chaos of the last 30 years.
Yeah.
The dot-com bust, the 2008 financial crisis, global pandemics, zero interest rate policies. How often do interest rates stay frozen for 30 years? Absolutely never. So the next time you look at a 30-year yield to maturity quote on a trading screen, and you start making long-term financial plans based on that precise number, ask yourself, is that yield a guarantee or is it just a mathematical fantasy?
A mathematical fantasy. I love it. Good luck on the Series 7. Don't let the exam writers trick you on the 30 seconds. Keep studying.